So a good hour ahead. Now, telephone number 133-882. I spoke with one-time independent presidential candidate and friend, TJ O'Hara from the US, yesterday about the election ahead next year, a pivotal one in terms of the ramifications domestically and internationally. The presidential election is less than a year away now. In fact, the caucuses in Iowa happen in a few weeks. And whilst the two front runners for their respective parties are well ahead, you get the feeling there's a way to go yet. TJ explained yesterday how things could still turn around with Nikki Haley surging on the Republican side. We talked about President Biden's obvious signs of cognitive deterioration. They're obvious to anyone who cares to look and isn't politically partisan. And we looked at the many and various character flaws of Donald Trump, which are also obvious if you look at it objectively. A discussion then ensued after that when an emailer, that'd be you, Cherie, wondered why there was more talk about Biden's issues than Trump's. Well, I think we're actually talking about both their issues. I would have thought that people know who they are getting with Donald Trump. We've seen a lot of him now. Love him or loathe him, you know what you're getting. Biden's issues, cognitively, are new. They're different. But if character is the key question, I also asked out loud, how is Trump's character, for example, worse than John Kennedy's, who is held up by many to be a hero? Kennedy's image was classy, but the image was very different to the real man when you learn more about the real man. Now, I liked him, but I also understand his flaws. The reality was very, very different. And he was protected by a compliant press, including one of his best friends, Ben Bradley, who ran the Washington Post, and people who conspired to create that image. Donald Trump never quite had that. No defense of Donald Trump. He is what he is. But sometimes I think we need to look a little more widely. But it does get to this question of character in a president. You know, they've had men of great character. You know, your Dwight Eisenhower's, your Ronald Reagan's, Barack Obama. But you've had others who maybe didn't quite meet that. And I think they've got two of them right now. So let me ask TJ O'Hara, as he joins us from California, that question about character. G'day, TJ.
How are you doing, Greg?
Yeah, lovely to talk to you, mate. Thanks for taking the time again. The question of character is very important. What do we want in our leaders? And we've had, you know, one of our greatest prime ministers, Bob Hawke, great prime minister, but a bit deficient in many areas of his character. So how important is character in our political leaders?
It's important to a large segment of the voters. It's certainly important to me. It's one of the reasons I ran in 2012. But unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be particularly important to the parties. The parties are focused on the prize. They want to parade the presidency as a trophy. And as long as they win it, character falls by the wayside. And it's unfortunate. I think if I was to define it, and we're talking about one of the most important jobs in the entire world, has no job description other than you have to be 35 and a citizen of the United States. That's pretty limited.
Yes.
Relative to qualities. But, you know, I think integrity, authenticity, honor, those are the types of things that you should look for and you should be able to expect in a president. And we don't have anyone running right now that probably fits that bill.
So does that say something about changing expectations of the public there, that they're prepared to accept candidates? Because Biden's got heaps of character flaws as well as Trump. So does that relate to the electors or of the political class more widely now?
I think it reflects on the party. The party's determined through their primary and caucus season that's just coming up. They determine who their nominee is going to be. And that's the only choice you have if you're going to vote within party lines. If you go through an independent or a third party, you have a broader selection. But if you believe that you have to choose among the lesser of two evils, that's exactly what the parties are going to give you.
Yeah, and that was admirable why you ran, I think it was 2012, wasn't it? You were making a statement, yeah, about all of that. I mean, it takes a fortune to be elected president. You never had a chance to win, but you were making a point, weren't you?
Exactly. I wasn't trying to win. What I was trying to do is educate the electorate and provide them with a context that they could look at and say, okay, maybe we should expect more. Maybe we should demand more. And this is what a candidate looks like who's not running for a political purpose, but rather from a leadership standpoint. And that's where my candidacy was somewhat unique at that point.
Okay, so pivotal election. I mean, all elections have consequences here, there, everywhere. But this seems to be a very important one in all kinds of ways, domestically and internationally. What are the big issues that we'll be hearing about over the next 6-7 months?
Well, certainly the economy And right now the president has a 70% disapproval rating relative to how he's handling the economy. Inflation is slowing, but the cumulative inflation since he assumed the presidency is about 17, a little more than 17%. So that's going to be a big issue because he may say that we're doing well and that the media isn't reporting it the right way. The problem is people go to the stores, and pragmatically, they understand they're not doing better. Immigration is another one. We have about 3.8 million illegal immigrants since he assumed office. We're currently averaging roughly 10,000 a day. To put that in perspective, that would double your population in Australia in about a little over 7 years.
Yes.
So it's an extreme problem. And now that it's moved away from Texas and the people are migrating into these quote-unquote sanctuary cities that have always embraced the concept of illegal immigrants, they embraced that until the immigrants actually came. So there's a paradigm shift. Now they're all upset and they want the border shut down.
But just on the border, if I could just ask you this question related to the border, because we look from over here and we see that southern border of yours absolutely smashed. They're pouring in, as you say, 10,000 a day, millions over the last few years. Mate, they're coming from China, they're coming from Pakistan, they're coming from Chile, they're coming from Iran, they're coming from China. Mate, terrorists are coming in over your border. Nobody seems to care too much.
That's one of the dangers. There are problems. You've got with the people on the terrorist watch list, we had 169 that they identified this year. Not that actually came over. There may have been more that came over, but they identified 169 of them. There were 98 last year, 15 the year before that. And that exacerbates the potential for the next terrorist attack. And no one who's facilitating this influx is ever going to take responsibility for that. So a serious drain on resources.
Yes.
Because we're providing food, clothing, shelter, while our homeless remain on the streets. And add to that the opioid crisis.
So that'll be a big issue. That opioid crisis, again, killing hundreds of thousands of Americans a year. And again, I'm amazed that no one is really cracking down on that. That'll be a big issue, yeah?
I think so. We lose about 150 people per day. That's like an airliner crashing each day and nobody's doing anything about it. So that's a big issue.
Sure is. Another big issue, and we've seen it here too, TJ, and we've seen it writ large in the United States, and that's what the United States is in many ways. It's the rest of the democratic world writ large fighting out a lot of the big issues. But I've been amazed, disgusted, surprised by the rise of anti-Semitism over there and here, but over there, what have you made of all of that?
Well, I think it's been fanned by the political divide. In our country, it must always be an us versus them type of struggle. So people pick sides. And in this most recent time, I think there's a lot of confusion. There's a lack of understanding, a lack of education and awareness. They've conflated religion in a governed country with governance in a theocracy. People don't understand that balance. And it's been disgusting, quite honestly. We have 20% of our college students. Now, these are the educated future elites of the United States. 20% think the Holocaust never happened, and 25% think it was greatly exaggerated.
Incredible. It's just incredible, isn't it? And I heard the presidents of three of your major universities before the Congress last week being asked about these limits of free speech. You know, people running around Harvard saying, gas the Jews, genocide to the Jews. And the president of Harvard, a lady called Gay, was asked the hypothetical question, does calling for the genocide of Jews violate Harvard's rules on bullying and harassment? And she had trouble answering that question to the extent that she had to try three more days in the days to come. Why is that such a hard question for the president of Harvard, one of the elite institutions in the world, to answer?
It shouldn't be. But that goes to some of the other challenges that we have. And I would suggest that it's an erosion of our culture. It's a cultural decline that's surfacing now. And everybody wants to be politically correct. So there were three people testifying that
yes.
day, one from Penn, one from Harvard, and I forget the other university. But they were all coached beforehand by the same attorney. So, you know, you have an attorney trying to tell them what to say in a cute way and a clever way, but it was appalling to a normal person. Protesting a genocide of the Jews shouldn't be a difficult question to answer.
No. Free speech is a big deal over there. It's your First Amendment, and I get what free speech is. But I do wonder, I'd be interested in your answer, whether free speech can in fact go too far. When your founder set up free speech, it was for specific reasons, and you can explain to us those reasons. But back then you had 3 million people. Now we've got social media, and America has 330 million people. And you've got polarized voices yelling and screaming all day long, creating this sewer of an atmosphere out there. Is that what free speech was intended? And is there an impact and a limit to what that free speech should be allowed to do and say?
Well, in my opinion, and I think the Supreme Court would back me up on this, the First Amendment was never meant to be easy. It's probably the most difficult set of rights that we have, speech being among them. And not all speech is free. The court has identified obscenity, defamation, fraud, incitement, fighting words, true threats, speech integral to criminal conduct, and child pornography as exceptions. And there's some commercial ones like copyright infringement and so forth. So you can't necessarily say anything that you want. If it's going to trigger a reasonable threat to others, that's not protected speech. Mm-hmm. The problem is we've created a category that doesn't exist called hate speech in this country.
Yes.
And that falls more within inciting violence or discriminating against individuals or groups. But we've, I hate to use the phrase, but bastardized the actual definition of that term and twisted freedom of speech. I think freedom of speech can be difficult. Someone can say something that I find completely appalling, but if it's geared towards inciting violence, then that's no longer protected. And that's what's happening on the college campuses in the protests.
Yeah.
They're calling for the elimination of Jews. That's not protected speech.
And it's also the kind of thing that used to happen in the universities of Berlin and Munich in the early 30s leading up to the Second World War. It's appalling. Maybe we've only got a couple of minutes left, but we finish on some lighter stuff because I know you love your sport and you were a very fine tennis player. We're losing some of the great ones. Roger's given it away. Who was your favorite tennis player of all time?
Well, when I was growing up, it was the Rocket. It was Rod Laver from your backyard.
Yeah, they're listening in Rockhampton this afternoon. Yeah.
Yeah, another great player. When I was playing, Bjorn Borg, Jimmy Connors, who I wasn't fond of, but was a great player,
yeah.
John McEnroe. Then you had the next evolution, Pete Sampras, Andre Agassi. But I would say probably if I had to identify the best player, probably Novak Djokovic.
Yeah.
Going to be playing on Australia soon. I would say Roger Federer. Now, I'm going to use a different term, not the best player, but the greatest player. I think he had the most fluid game. He was the most remarkable at inventing what he needed to win when he was at his height. And then I would say Rafa Nadal, the toughest competitor. If my life depended on somebody's effort, I'm picking Rafa Nadal to go play for me because he just would never quit.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of great players coming up. You're going to see in Australia soon. Carlos Alcaraz, Jannik Sinner, I think he's going to be a great player. And even he's a little bit older, but Medvedev is a fine player. So you've got a new generation coming up. It's going to be tough to replace Djokovic, Federer, and Nadal, but great, great players coming up.
Okay. Final question. Australia's trying to get into the U.S., get a toehold there in rugby league. They're starting the season next year in Las Vegas. Any hope?
You know, I think you're going to be surprised, but the San Diego Legion is our rugby team. They were 16-1, most wins in Major League Rugby history. They had the longest winning streak, 14 games. They scored the most points. They were undefeated at home, the largest point differential. And they just signed some Australian guy named Matt Cato.
Yeah.
You may have heard of him. He played for some team called the Wallabies.
And some team.
we're looking forward to seeing him this year. So it's picking up. I think, you know, we're a free economy, and the ticket prices range from $19 to $189 for that doubleheader they're going to play. Now, if you want to compare that to where it probably stands as a sport in the United States, the Las Vegas Raiders, the football team, their tickets start at $228, and they reach $938. So there's a gap, but it's a learning curve, and it's just like soccer. Football, as we would term it in other countries, but soccer in the United States, it's starting to make headways. And particularly during World Cup, people were really excited about it. I think rugby has that same potential.
Covered a lot of territory, TJ. Always appreciate it. You take care and have a very happy new year. I know Sophie will talk to you throughout the year.